This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your desktop or mobile device. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. Also, help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day by becoming a Trek FM patron through Patreon. Get access to exclusive content and become part of the team. You'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated books and comics show. I am your host, Matthew Rushing, and not here with me this week is Dan Gunther. Dan is on a secret special Section 31 assignment. I can't tell you where he is, obviously, or I'd have to kill you. And so that means that we're going to have a very, very short news segment this week. In fact, I'm not really going to cover any news at all because there's so much news that's come out recently. We've got some book covers to judge and things like that. I really can't do it justice without Dan. I just don't feel that it would be right for me to talk about without him being here and to bounce those ideas off. And we've even got some comics to review as well. So it's going to be a great episode next week for that in news. I hope you'll join us there. And this week, though, I didn't want you to miss Literary Treks and have a great interview with Tony Daniel, the author, whose newest book has just come out, that's Savage Trade. So I'm really excited to be able to still bring you that, even though Dan is away on his secret mission. Well, I am really excited for the listeners this week. Guys, we have something really special for you. I love when we get to do interviews, and Savage Trade has come out, the latest TOS book from this year, and I'm really excited that Tony Daniel is here to talk about that with us. Tony, it's great to have you back here on the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Awesome. Well, last time, you know, your last book was following up an episode of the original series, and Savage Trade does that as well. Tell me a little bit here about the genesis and for you of Savage Trade. Where did this idea come from?
Well, the first one was because I love the Horta, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yep, yep.
That was called Devil's Bargain.
Yeah, great work with the Horta. So much fun to see that race back.
And so I figured I had luck with Silicon Creatures. I told somebody I wanted to be invited as guest of honor to Silicon.
There you go. I'm surprised we haven't started that up yet.
Well, I've always liked I like that episode for, I mean, it's one of the most derided of the original series episodes, but yet I always, it has a place in my heart for some reason. I've always enjoyed watching mm-hmm. it over. So I wanted to do something with those guys, the Scalbians.
Mm-hmm.
We don't even, I guess we learned their name in the episode. We don't learn the mm-hmm. name of the, of our host, the rock creature, but I wanted to bring him back as well. It's even to talk about the book at all is going to have a minor spoiler.
Definitely. We will go ahead and let the listeners know this is your spoiler warning. If you haven't read Savage Trade, which hopefully you have by now, we are going to talk about the book and we're going to go in depth in it. So just consider this your spoiler warning. And if you do continue, that's not Tony and I's fault. So,
well, it's not a huge spoiler. I mean, you can't talk. The book has the Escalbians in it, but it's mm-hmm. not until,
yep.
you know, about 20 pages in that it's revealed that they're part of the story. But you can't really talk about anything else about the story unless you talk about that. I think.
Well, dealing with the Escalbians again, you know, and trying to build off of what had happened in TOS. What was that like, really fleshing out that race?
Well, I mean, it was, they're so sort of loathsome in that episode, and I wanted to find their motivation. What would cause a species to want to do that to others? And could it really be that they didn't understand the difference between good and evil and such things? That, you know, a lot of the silliness that some people have seen in that episode, I wanted to give an explanation for, to to try to make it make sense. So I was, and I just really like writing species who are completely and utterly alien to human ways of thinking. That it's fun because you have a blank slate in a way that, I mean, you don't have to, your creation of their characters can be wildly weird, in other words.
Well, and when you're watching the original series, or honestly, really any of the Star Trek shows, you know, we're very limited on what we can do with aliens, and just how alien they can get. And I think you really start to push the boundaries when you got to Voyager, and we did Species 8472, where it's just something that is there's no humanoid about it, you know. But that's when I think the best parts of the literature is that we can create things that are truly alien, that, you know, we would think of that we might truly run into in a spacefaring, you know, show.
Yeah, and you can, in a book, you don't have, you're not limited by the fact that you have to have humans acting the parts of the alien.
Right, exactly.
But speaking of Voyager, my best friend was a longtime staff writer on Voyager, Michael Taylor, and he wrote some great great Voyagers, I think. With he had one, you know, The Bride of Chaotica, I believe it's called.
That's a classic.
Has some very odd aliens behind it all. Yeah, that's I wrote that one.
That's so cool. Yeah, that's actually one of my favorite Voyager episodes, just because, like you said, it, you know, it has some very interesting alien characters that are truly alien, and at the same time, it is just, you know, hysterical, you know, with Janeway having to play off as being Chaotica and everything. Oh, gosh, I really enjoyed that episode, so.
Yeah, and that robot. I love that robot.
Yes, yes. That robot's awesome.
Mike's description in the script is it looks like a walking garbage can.
It's so funny. I'm wondering, I know Trek author Jeff Lang is a huge robot fan. I'm wondering if he has you know, a action figure of Satan's robot in his collection.
Could be.
Yeah, that's a great one. Well, okay, so with the Excalibians, one of the most interesting things in there is the fact that, you know, they don't have this understanding of right and wrong, and especially, you know, very much grounded in the 60s, even though we're having the cultural revolution happen, there's still very much that feeling of right and wrong, and Kirk often gives his, you know, Kirk speech about what's right. But I thought this was so interesting, you know, Kirk having to deal with this again, and really that there is kind of a universal idea. Even Kirk thinks this in the book, you know, about there being evil and good and all of that. Talk about kind of riding that line of philosophy and ethics in this, you know, multicultural universe of Star Trek, and trying to divine, okay, what could we boil down and say, well, this is good and this is evil, when we have all of these myriad of races all around us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I figure that, I mean, the Federation itself seems to be based on something like the UN human rights, articles of human rights. And I figure that Kirk probably would stick to those pretty, and, you know, and to the Bill of Rights from the American Constitution as well. I think those are his touchstones that could, that could bring, you know, a diverse, here we are in a diverse culture trying to bring it together as best we can. The same thing with, you know, the Federation is a melting pot writ large. So I think that he believes the things you might see in the UN Charter on human rights. That's, and I would, I kind of based, you know, what Kurt would say off of some of that.
Well, and what was interesting, and as you expounded upon the Excalibians, and just talk a little bit about creating that race and giving them that depth. How did you kind of come up with where they had come from?
Well, the thing that I was trying to figure out, how could they not know the difference between good and evil? And my thought was that if they were complete solipsists, if they didn't believe the outside world really existed and that only they existed, that could be an explanation for what they were willing to do to the Enterprise and their crew in that episode. You know, they threatened the ship, and they would very well have destroyed it, probably, just for fun, or just for the search for knowledge, as Yannick says, at the end of the episode. So I thought that they would be sort of a semi-differentiated group mind, and they all sort of thought that they were all that existed, and that everything else was a plaything of the mind, including our characters, you know, everyone. And I tried to give them some comeuppance as well, because Kirk doesn't really get to give them the comeuppance they deserve at the end of the Savage Curtain. I kind of wanted to punish him for doing that to our guys.
And it was really interesting because, you know, you talked about their genesis as a race and how they came into be, and this whole idea that they're really the only ones there. And, you know, they have this ability to create and they become to see themselves as, you know, basically godlike characters. And I thought it was really interesting. And what we kind of see in TOS specifically is that absolute power really does corrupt, you know, these races. You know, they begin to think of themselves as God, and then they play that out. And how interesting that is in the TOS milieu, because, you know, I feel like when we move towards TNG and Deep Space Nine and Voyager, our attitudes are kind of changing on that. But
well, in a way,
TOS,
I mean, is certainly a, you know, isn't the most upright of characters for somebody that's pretty mm-hmm. all-powerful.
Yeah, definitely. Well, two, what was really interesting here with the Excalibians is, you know, because they are seeing themselves as, you know, above everyone else, you know, they don't really pay attention to anything around them. You know, they don't really care about anything around them. And what I loved is that you like you said, they get their comeuppance, you know, that feeling like nobody really has anything to truly teach them, you know, you're going to kind of pay for that assumption. And I really like that they have to pay for what they've kind of been plaguing on all of these different races that pass by their planet.
Yeah. And then they play with the wrong race. I don't know how much we would want to go into the plot, but they do assume some historical characters just like they do in the episode, which was a lot of fun to do.
Well, yeah, that is really interesting. You know, it's always fascinating, I think, in Star Trek when they use those characters. But talk about just which characters you use, why you decided to use them, and all the research that kind of went in there for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I wanted to use George Washington because I wrote a novel about George Washington, and I know a lot about him, especially his younger years. He's not that wooden guy on the dollar bill, you know. He was quite the action hero when he was 21, out in the wilderness there. He did some amazing things, and I've always liked him. And he's very flawed as a person. He's incredibly neurotic when you start really looking into his life. Very much mm-hmm. a mother fixation problem. and he's this interesting guy. And so I wanted to sort of bring him back. And I picked out people that I wanted to, and I wanted to give McCoy, finally give him a girl that was
right.
worthy of him.
Yep.
So I searched for the best historical girl, the prettiest and smartest that he could ever have. We hit upon the
awesome
woman that Voltaire said, what did he say about her? A great man whose only fault was being a woman. That was Voltaire's take on her. She was his mistress for a time as well. And she also translated Newton's Principia into French.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she predicted the existence of ultraviolet and infrared light. So this was a smart woman. I'm talking about Émilie Duchâtelet, the French thinker and courtesan. So, and she was beautiful.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I thought that that was something that was really great to see, you know. Bones in so many places, you know, is always definitely playing, you know, third fiddle to Kirk and Spock. And I really liked that he had this whole storyline. You know, he really got something interesting to do. And, you know, before Kirk in this book, he gets the girl, which I loved seeing him kind of just kind of open up and really let loose for Bones.
Yeah, yeah. I always thought he deserved that, you know. His, and in some of the original series episodes, his girl's always getting killed off.
Yes.
Like asteroids are running into their planets and things like that. So I want to give him something. And Kirk has an interesting relationship going on that had mm-hmm. to be difficult to develop. That couldn't be a, you know, Kirk smiles and she's his kind of relationship. Mm-hmm. I wanted to give Kirk something difficult to work on as well, instead of your standard TOS romance plot. Not that there's some good ones in there.
Oh, definitely. Well, and I think that was one of the things that made it so interesting throughout the novel, because I felt like you did a great job of giving us that mystery. Okay, is Kirk going to be able to kind of win this woman over by the end of the novel? You know, you left that very much a mystery throughout the entire book. And I liked that I wasn't sure if it was ever going to progress that far, you know?
Yeah, I'm still not sure.
Yeah. Hey, that's great. You know, there you go. It's up to the reader at that point to say whether or not it went any farther. Yeah, I love that. And because that to me, it gives you an investment when you're reading, because TOS is so formulaic sometimes. It's nice that you're shaking up the formula here. You know, you're making, you know, McCoy be the one who's the lady killer in this book, and having Kirk be the one who's having to work really hard for it.
That's
it's
true.
Awesome.
But I'm still worshiping the formula in my, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
The formula, you know, the formula, you could also say it's great storytelling, you know, and it's always mm-hmm. going to have a certain a number of beats to it, et cetera. So, you know, I love the original series, don't get me wrong, but, you know, you got to try different things to make it interesting. And I wanted to give a takeaway that like you said, the reader could think about, could this relationship possibly work? You know, that's, As you finish.
Yeah, that's something that's so interesting about the story, is because I think people come away from TOS kind of feeling like we understand or know Vulcans. But if you only watch TOS, you know very little about this race.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's really through, you know, Enterprise that we feel like we know more. And the rest of the series, until we got to Voyager, stayed away from Vulcans so much of the time. It talked to me about exploring Vulcans, because Kirk's main squeeze in the movie, the one that he's, you know, working with very closely, and not in that way, people, get your mind out of the gutter, but he's having to work very closely within the book, to deal with the problem of the Excalibians, as well as everything else, is Vulcan. And she's also a very close friend of Spock. And talk about exploring, you know, and kind of opening up what it means to be Vulcan.
Well, I wanted to, she's also the one that she has a great deal of power in deciding the fate of everyone mm-hmm. in the, mm-hmm. she's, and Kirk's gotta obey her because she's a Federation representative, which she chased at as well a bit. But she has, she's a protege of Spock's dad. But before that, she's not exactly friends with Spock. They're sort of, Spock was friends or close with her twin brother, mm-hmm. When they were young. And in fact, they were sort of antagonists back then, and it's something that she regrets as a logical error, of course, not as a real regret.
Right, exactly.
But and I wanted to, one thing, I needed to have her possibly unattached romantically, so there could be that possibility. So I needed to come up with some way that Ponfar would not be come into play. And so I came up with something that I hope will fly with the Cognoscenti, that Vulcan twins don't bond in the same way, the pair bond of the Ponfar, the Vulcan's strange salmon-like relationships with each other, so that she could truly be unattached. And so I did that with twins, and then I figured that they were very close, she and her brother, and when he became enamored with Spock in his mind, Spock's mind, there might have been a sort of logical jealousy there. And I wanted to bring that forward into the future. Right now they're meeting years later. She realizes she was mistaken about, Spock being half human was not a detriment. It was perhaps even something good. And how's she going to deal with that being a Vulcan? Because you can't feel sorry. You're going to have regrets that you made a logical error.
Right.
So how would they do that? How would Vulcans work out that sort of baggage from their childhood was interesting to me. And also she works for his dad. So there's that.
Yes.
And I made her, and I needed to make her also somebody who understood humans as well. She's not, mm-hmm. so that she could have some sort of empathy for Kirk and the others. So and she is also protege of Amanda Grayson as well, who's a close mm-hmm. friend of hers and a mentor as well.
I really liked the fact that you opened up Spock's family like that and made Amanda just as important in not only Spock's development, but also Valak's development as well. And that just as much as she had to learn from Sarek, she had a lot to learn from Amanda. And I thought that was really, really nice to see, because I feel like so many times, in Star Trek, except for really the 2009 version, Amanda is pushed to the sidelines a lot. And yet you would think there would be something pretty spectacular about this woman if Sarek of Vulcan decides to marry her.
Yeah, exactly. And they're married, and one could even say that Sarek would not have been the great man that he became without her. They really seem like a team, even in the Babel episode. What's the name of that episode? I can't remember. But when they're all going to the conference,
Journey to Babel.
Yes, yeah. So she certainly seems like just his equal, and there's something that really works in that relationship. So how can a human and Vulcan have that sort of, and it seems romantic in its way. Mm-hmm. How can that happen? What is it that gels there? And it's not explained in the episode where they put together in the original series. It's just presented as a fact. And I kind of wanted to think, how could that happen? How could a human and a Vulcan really get to the point where they might want to spend the rest of their lives together in such a way and mm-hmm. have kids?
Writing in TOS is, especially when talking about the formula, it's very much the Kirk, Spock, and then McCoy show, and then everybody else just kind of fills in. And I felt like in this book, you really did a great job of naturally kind of working in every single character in the book and making it feel like, I'm not feeling like he's feeling he has to, put Sulu at the forefront here, Chekhov here, Uhura here. Just really having them work very naturally throughout the story. Kind of talk about that balance that as an author, you have all these great characters and you're trying to find ways to service them that work best, you know, for you as the storyteller, but also for the character.
Yeah, I mean, the way to think about it, the way I thought about it was, is that in many ways, the main character of the original series is the Enterprise crew itself working together so well, because they're all just extraordinary people that have come together. Nobody's not extraordinary in that crew. So they would all do extraordinary things, and they get and they have interests that are their interests. Uhuru does communications, and so she would naturally be used to check some communication stuff that she needs to do, and she finds something in the book. And I wanted, for once, for Chekhov to be not the scapegoat, not the youngest guy around, for once, because, you know, he's pretty extraordinary himself, and, you know, I wanted to give him a good moment of mentorship with absolutely new red shirt. So, and that was really fun to write. And, you gotta fill up the book. So you need to have the characters do things. It can't all be Kirk and Spock. So, and it needs to all gel together, of course. That's the main thing. It's gotta come back together, and the story has to tie up into a real story and not disparate threads. So, yeah, you know, you gotta juggle all that. And I made outlines and worked them over and worked them over again. That's, you know, part of the process.
When you were coming up with the historical figures that we would see, you know, besides George Washington, how did you come to who we'd see, and did you ever think of adding, you know, other characters from other time periods or other races, or you know, as we had seen in the episode?
I could have, I could have even added some people from other Star Treks as well, which would have maybe been fun. But the thing is that I figure that these guys are escapees from a particular episode that they were reenacting. And they're all basically from pretty much the same time period, because they were in a reenactment that, you know, one of the plays the Excalibians like to put on. And I wanted to match somebody up to each of the characters of the main characters as well. So Kirk got Washington, Scotty got James Watt, et cetera. And Spock gets my favorite guy of all from the past.
Ben Franklin.
And it's, I don't know. It just, truthfully, it's just the guys I wanted to research. I always wanted to know more about, like, I had heard and knew somewhere in the back of my mind that James Watt hadn't just invented the condenser on the steam engine, but that he had invented carbon paper. I was like, who was this guy?
Oh, wow.
So, and he invented a lot of other stuff too. He was a self-made man. He started out as an instrument maker in the University of Glasgow. He didn't, come from great wealth or anything like that. So, and he's Scottish.
Right, exactly. Well, you had me going there because, you know, when him and Scotty are having this amazing scotch, I was super jealous because I'm a big scotch fan myself.
I said Glasgow. I think it was Edinburgh. But anyway, I wanted to, what was the best scotch ever? You know, it's the first scotch that ever existed that was really scotch historically, and it wasn't ruined because it wasn't 1,000 years old. It was just exactly the right age.
Yeah, that was awesome.
So I did quite a lot of research on scotch, and I really participated in that research too. I have a friend who has quite a few of them, and we went through some of them too.
Well, that is the best kind of research right now, if you ask me.
Exactly. I'm researching. Leave me alone.
That's right. Just one more.
One more datum I need to examine here. Yeah. Well, it was fun. And I love single malt scotch as well. So,
yeah, I'm with you. I'm a huge fan myself. So tell me about kind of creating some of the other races that you did for the book. I mean, there are some shadowy races like the Haradrim and the La Haraine. You have the Demiurge. Just talk about creating these races and kind of where you, you know, it seemed like you were setting up some things too that we could really see again.
Yeah, I maybe would use that again. I enjoyed the idea that that there was this rather horrible empire that existed about in our time frame out there that mysteriously disappeared, and why nobody was quite sure of, and they might still be around. And they were slavers. They had slaves, and they dealt in slaves. And when you have slavers, you would have a subspecies of humans here that deals with slave ships and such. But I'd spend them a sort of parasitic species in their own right. That's the Larani. And, you know, they're pretty – it's good to have some despicable villains. There's not much mm-hmm. good to say about those guys. They are slavers, and they deserve whatever happens to them. That and it gave me a place to put a MacGuffin in as well, which is something that they have on their ship that they don't quite know how to use, but that that might be useful for our guys, our people.
Mm-hmm. And where did you come up with the idea for the Demiurge, which will be kind of like the final battle in the book, and right. really the thing that the crew has to overcome?
Well, the thing is that the Escalbians are pretty much omnipotent. And so what could mm-hmm. beat an Escalbian is what my task was there. What could they be afraid of? You know, that, and that's, and my thought was something that sucked them all dry of their mind. That was just, was powerful, knew so much more than they did. And the Demiurge is as much above the Escalbians as they are above us poor humans in mm-hmm. mentality. So, I needed something like that. And there's, you know, we get a glimpse that there might be other things that are even scarier than the Demiurge, briefly in the book as well. But I needed something that's where it came from, is the idea. What could the Escalbians possibly really be afraid of? I don't want to say too much more about it, because it'll give too much away.
I really liked
the, and it sort of, the other thing I thought about that came to me was from A Wrinkle in Time, where, you know, Meg is looking out and the stars seem mm-hmm. to be covered with this black. That's the Demiurge
yes.
to me.
I like that. That's really nice to know that that's kind of where it comes from. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, that's what I was visualizing. So, not a nice thing.
Oh, no, not at all. What I wondered, too, with the Escalbians, and this question of kind of personhood and, you know, for them, who they are in the universe, has got to be one of the most difficult things, especially since they take on these forms. And, you know, are they really their own person, or are they just a copy? And that was a really interesting question that I just kind of wrestled with throughout the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, who would have thought I could try to pull Philip K. Dick into a Star Trek novel? But it's fun, you know. It's fun to because Kirk is, that's the end of the Savage Curtain, is Kirk and Spock and McCoy just, you know, discussing whether that was really Lincoln. It really felt like Lincoln to Kirk, you know, and because it was mm-hmm. his absolute conception of Lincoln. But was it really Lincoln? How can, you know, it passed the Turing test, so shouldn't it, you know, it really was Lincoln in a way. So, you know, it's what's real and what's not. if something is reconstructed, but it's exactly what your perception of it would be if it was real, then isn't it really real? I don't know. But it's fun to play around.
And that leads right into the whole idea, too, especially with the Excalibians of, you know, they do all these thought experiments and they play out these plays. But mm-hmm. there's really no, there's nothing that makes up for experience, real experience, you know, happening to you in the physical world. You can't replace that.
Yeah, and that's the thing about the Excalibians is that there's that as many thought experiments are in many ways useful, but in a lot of ways when you don't have anything. You know, you don't have any empirical evidence to back anything up. You could just think anything, and you're caught in like infinite loops of solipsism. And that's my thought. That's what happened to the. You know, they're very rational. They're extremely rational. They're as logical as Vulcans, but they weren't confronted with having to go out to fight to live to. Propagate because of the sort of creatures that they evolved from. And so they're just caught up in endless circular thought, like a crazy person, you know, reenacting. And to break out of that, they had this, it seemed to me that they need to become sort of less than they are so that they can find some way out so they can think straight, you know, so they can think anything that's not a, doesn't have a thousand different, you know, tree limbs going off of it. That leads them back into the same mess that they left from. Confused, really, really smart people can be extremely confused people sometimes. And sometimes the person that just sees things clearly and maybe is not the smartest, you know, the sharpest knife in the drawer is still the one that you need in a certain situation. And for them to break out of that mental trap they worked themselves into, something like that would have to happen. I thought.
Well, and in that too, I really liked that. I felt like it came down to, you know, the moment that you think you know it all is the moment you really don't know anything, you know, because you really stop learning, you stop challenging yourself. And
yes, exactly. Because if it's just you and the universe is your creation, you really can't learn anything because it's all you. So I think it's necessary, even though many people have said solipsism is impossible to refute as a philosophy. There's some famous, I think Bertrand Russell talked to a woman who said, he quotes this somewhere, who said, solipsism is such a logically pure philosophy. I don't see why everyone is in a solipsist, which is a bit ironic because it would only be one person. Everybody else would be robots. But
right.
But it is almost impossible to refute it, but you can't, but it ends there. You know, philosophy and science and everything else would just end there. If you just have to go beyond it. Maybe even have faith that there's a world out there that you can know and that might teach you things that you didn't know before, and that, you're not everything, and that some things are worth finding out about, and you could even become a better person than you thought you were. So, which I think is something we all might agree on.
Well, and I think that's one of the things that really makes us Star Trek fans is because, you know, that's kind of the premise of the show is to seek out what we don't know. And, you know, I always think back to, there's a great episode of Doctor Who where the 10th Doctor says that he's out there to find out what he doesn't know and to challenge his own beliefs and to be proven wrong even. And I think that's, you know, to make sure that he could actually be on the right path, so to say. You know, he could actually know what he knows. And you don't know what you don't know until you know what you didn't know. And that's one of the best parts about Star Trek is that we say we don't know, so we're going to go out and find out. And I think that's what keeps us coming back for the books and for the show.
Very noble undertaking and bold.
Well, and Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, and it takes courage, I think, to do that, to say we don't know, we're not sure that what we think is correct, and we want to challenge that. So, yeah, I think it takes utmost courage to challenge one's own beliefs, especially even if they're their core beliefs.
Yeah, absolutely. On the other hand, I think Kirk and company do come back to some basic, I don't know if they're beliefs so much as some, you know, the things like don't mess with other people and let, the freedom matters. These, I think these are things that that are necessary for us to examine our other core beliefs. You know, you have to have someone able to speak against your whatever it is you think in order to, you know, put it to the test. Because everybody was forced to talk and think in the same way, you would never test it. So there are certain things that arise out of that need to boldly go and find out things that are universals. And I think that's treating individuals as worthy is one of them, you know, and that speech should be free. And unless you're going to shout photon torpedo in a crowded theater, I guess.
Right. Exactly. Well, Tony, what else do you have that, you know, that you're working on that the listeners need to know about? And then, too, do you have any other Star Trek works in the fire?
Not at the moment, but I'm certainly open to more. I'm also an editor at Bain Books. And I do a podcast there, which is really fun. I interview our writers there. That's something I do every week. It's called the Bain Free Radio Hour. Yeah, it's incredibly fun to being a writer to interview other writers. I feel like I know some of the things to ask them that gets them going. Instead of like, what kind of pencil do you write with, or whatever.
What kind of pencil do you write with, Tony?
Oh, my God. I don't even know what a pencil is.
I know. That's awesome. I can't imagine somebody actually asking that question anymore.
Well, you know, I have friends that write with pencils and longhand. I don't. I even use Dragon Speech sometimes.
Or
whatever voice recognition software. I've done that before.
Oh, that's really cool.
It would be great if I could just think and write, you know, if my thoughts would be, but there's still the editing process. It wouldn't matter what, you know,
you still have to go through and edit.
So I'm working on, at the moment, believe it or not, I'm working on High Fantasy is incredibly fun because I've always wanted to write one. And it will be done this year, and it'll come out probably 2016 sometime.
Okay,
that's the current project.
Any tidbits for the listeners of just kind of the basic of what it's about?
Well, it's a young adult novel, I think, in that it has young adult protagonists at the moment, but I certainly think it's for adults as well, and it's not an incredibly new idea, but it's based on a what if the Vikings had stayed when they got to Nova Scotia and established their Newfoundland and established their base there, and what if they had populated North America, encountered the Native Americans, and the East Coast was basically divided into little kingdoms and fiefdoms and earldoms in medieval times stayed here and came here, and there's castles and keeps in places like on the Potomac and my heroes he starts out being, he's the third son, so he knows he's not even the spare to the heir in a kingdom that is the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, basically.
Okay.
And it's threatened because there's a really nasty... I created what I think is really fun psychic vampire that that are threatening this. So
awesome.
It sounds like a mishmash of crazy stuff, but I'm hoping to make it all work. I'm working desperately to make it all work right now. So, and it's
that sounds
fun.
Like a lot of fun, actually.
It is. I really like it.
Yeah, but, you know, I love that.
It's so much different than, you know, I had to create it from the ground up. Writing Star Trek novel is a lot like writing a poem in that there is a structure that you need to adhere to, or you're not writing a Star Trek novel. You know?
Right.
And that gives you a lot of freedom, too, because it gets you, you know, I can't do this, I can't do that. And so how am I going to do what I know I can do, you know, and make it interesting? And it really fires up your creativity in ways that, you know, it's like writing a sonnet. If you having to make that rhyme happen makes you explore areas that you wouldn't have explored in your thought necessarily if you were just writing free verse or whatever. So I love writing Star Trek novels. It's really fun as a writer of other
really
things.
Cool.
Yeah. It's a great experience, and being part of the whole community is wonderful as well. Finally, you know, having that connection that's really, really strong. So I know so many of my friends are you know, like Greg Cox, a great Star Trek novel writer, and my best friend Mike is, you know, long time. He wrote some Deep Space Nines that are classics as well. So I got some Star Trek in my blood now, by God, among my friends.
That's right. That's awesome. Well, I have to say that I have enjoyed both of the novels. I've thought that they have been really well done. I've really, The Devil's Bargain was, in fact, last week we were talking about books that were great Spock books, and that was one that we mentioned because I really enjoyed what you did with Spock in that book. And this one, I think, is such a fantastic ensemble piece. I really enjoyed the fact that all the characters had something enjoyable and interesting to do for them, and I would love to see a follow-up to this because I kind of want to know about some of those races that you created. I'd love to see kind of Kirk have to go after those slavers. I think that would make for a great follow-up, Tony.
Well, I like that idea. They do deserve to be punished, that's for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Rooted out. At least the readers can, in their mind, make that, you know, take it forward and say, this is what would, you know, you can write your own sequel if you like it enough. That's what you do with books.
Was we're writing that sequel with Kirk, and whether or not he gets the Vulcan love interest, we can also do the same thing with the aliens that Kirk will go after next. I love it.
And I hope it's an earbug, like a song that keeps going on in your mind after you finish the book. That's my hope. That's my intent. So you keep thinking about it afterwards, and you feel like you were royally entertained. That's my ultimate goal.
Well, before we let you go, where can everybody kind of find you online and kind of keep track of the things that will be coming out for you in the next few years?
Well, TonyDaniel.com. I am not the comic book artist Tony Daniel, by the way. I'm the other one. Believe me, people have made that mistake. Sometimes I think I penciled Batman, but... TonyDaniel.com, it's my Facebook page ultimately, and I just you know, keep a few announcements of things. I'm not a huge web guy. I have like three jobs: writing Star Trek novels, writing regular novels, and being an editor. It's like keeping up with a website is beyond me at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to use my Facebook page as author page as that. But please check it out.
And where can everybody find your podcast there for Bane Books?
You can go to Bane.com, and you can look at the pull down, which is Bane Community. And the podcast is one of the choices there. And we have, we have a lot, and there's some great writers. We have many interviews with, for instance, David Weber, Eric Flint, and just all sorts of writers. Some really interesting stuff. And I also interview cover artists. And we have some, you know, we use the best in the business, and we have some great great conversations with Bob Eggleton, Steve Hickman, people that are just legendary cover artists as well. So
that's awesome.
I really like doing it, and it's a maw that must be fed.
Yeah, definitely.
You probably understand.
That's awesome, Tony. I do. Doing three podcasts, I totally get it. So, well, thank you so much for joining us. We'll hope that we'll have you back soon because you'll have a new Star Trek book. But I really appreciate your time and getting to talk about Savage Trade.
Well, thank you, Matthew. I really appreciate it.
Well, I am really glad that I got to bring you guys this interview with Tony. It's so much fun doing this show, getting to talk to the authors. There's just really nothing like it. Having them on and kind of getting to pick their brains of what it's like to write a Star Trek novel is such a joy. But guys, it's not the only thing we've been talking about today here on Trek FM, Savage Trade. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And celebrate his life and celebrate his work and his talent and his integrity. And if you get a tear in the eye, that's okay. That's he would approve. Spock would approve. And, you know, he'd say, you humans, why do you feel you need to do this? But he would approve.
Earl Grey.
It's like I'm expecting Ricardo Martaban to, like, walk around the corner and be like, Captain Picard, welcome.
This is Risa 5.
The shuttlecraft.
The orb.
Usually you want to be able to capture it or isolate one, but you can't do that either because it just keeps, you know, so... really does seem like a conundrum of, okay, how do we take this down?
You know, this minefield, they are the tribbles of war.
To the journey! One guy's like, why don't we just write better stories for Wesley? And then the lead writer's like, you out now! The ready room.
Riker's all pissed because he can't prop his leg up with no gravity.
Yeah, he tries, though. He tries.
He's trying. I can picture it. He's
but got then the momentum makes him somersault.
Which really just makes him look spread eagle.
Going in circles.
He's spinning.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
It's also the end of a character and a thing that is really about how death is just a part of life. And that while there's an end, it doesn't mean that it's the end.
Literary Treks.
Well, actually, it started out life as a comic book pitch. I originally came up with it to pitch to Wildstorm back when they had the comics license. The idea was it would be a one-year series that would run throughout the 12 calendar months of 2001, which was the 35th anniversary of Star Trek.
The 602 Club.
Sometimes that just works better because you can create and craft a story that's very compelling because you're not having to worry about what's happened other places. Okay, we have to make sure this is going to connect to this, and my guess is somehow Agent Carter is going to have something to do with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. later on, and maybe something that happens in Age of Ultron.
Warp 5.
In the history of Axanar, Alec Peters and Christian Gossett wrote a section of the history dealing with the Arcanus campaign. And in the Arcanus campaign, a majority of Starfleet ships were destroyed.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we've been talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You will find us wherever you get your podcast. Guys, if you're an Apple user, be sure to hit that subscribe button. It really does help us out greatly when listeners are trying to find the show as they search for iTunes, as do star ratings and reviews. And just so you know, the reason we say these things is because that over 80% of podcast listeners get their materials, their podcasts from Apple. And so when you do these things for us, it really does help the show. It makes us rise in the iTunes rankings. It makes us more visible to listeners. And so we get a wider listening audience, which is fantastic for the network. So we really appreciate your help in those things. If you're not an Apple user, guys, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. And of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way that you can help keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreo.com/trekfm, you will find all the current goals and milestone contribution levels with the great perks that we have for you. You've got exclusive content, producer credits, seats on the content development team, and more. Guys, we really appreciate your support. We're a listener-supported network, so without you, we can't be doing this. So again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you'd like to contact us, just go to trek.fm/contact. You can choose a show, select that there, write the message. It'll get sent straight to me. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can do that on the sidebar of the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at trekfm, Facebook, facebook.com/trekfm, and then there's the listeners-only discussion group, the Babel Conference. Guys, that is the best way to get in touch with anybody here on the network. We love being in the Babel Conference, having some of the most fantastic conversations about Star Trek that you will find anywhere online. Just search the Babel Conference in the Facebook search field, or make it easier on yourself. Go to the website, trek.fm, and click discussion on the menu bar. We'd also like to thank Will Wynn, who is on Twitter at Will_Wynn. And of course, he's on the Babel Conference. He's an associate producer for The Orb, Earl Grey, and Literary Treks. He's also Trek FM's content coordinator. If you have any ideas for future shows, just send him an email at will.win@trekfm, or you can tweet him as well. We'd like to thank Lisa Stevens and Kenneth Tripp for their support of the network and being associate producers here on Literary Treks. You can find Lisa on Twitter at Flip18. Guys, really appreciate you joining us. Of course, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing The Orb with Christopher Jones, where we talk about Deep Space Nine exclusively. Then, of course, I do the 602 Club, where we talk about all things geeky that don't really have anything to do with Star Trek. Just pick a great topic each week and talk about that. It's so much fun. I hope you'll join me there. And then, of course, I'm on my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. And Dan will be with me next week, so I hope you guys will be ready for that. Thank you so much for joining me. And until next time, live long and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.